Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of June 8th, 2015. On this week's show, we'll talk about the first two games of the NBA Finals, both of which went to overtime, with regulation ending with LeBron James missing a game-winning shot, one of which featured the Cavaliers' Kyrie Irving breaking his kneecap, and which finished up on Sunday night with Cleveland and Golden State tied one game apiece. We'll then be joined by Sports Illustrated's Tim Layden to talk about American Pharoah winning the Belmont Stakes to become the first horse since 1978 to take the Triple Crown. And we'll finish up by talking about the start of the FIFA Women's World Cup, which will hopefully be an excellent event despite featuring the word FIFA. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic, and the man responsible for the entire $607 American box office take of the FIFA propaganda film United Passions, starring Tim Roth as Sepp Blatter.
I took my girl soccer team to see it, and we stayed for three viewings. $600. Yeah. We paid every time, though. We're honest.
The
honest
seven people. Was from tipping the usher for allowing you to just stay through every viewing. With us from New York and filling in for Mike Pesca is Mary Pallon. Mary is the author of the book The Monopolists, about the history of the board game Monopoly, which means I better have written a book about Settlers of Catan or I do not belong on this podcast. She's also just published a great piece on Grantland on the 40th anniversary of the death of Steve Prefontaine, the runner, which everyone should check out. Mary, it's fantastic to have you back on Hang Up and Listen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you may have noticed, Mary, that we're not going to talk about many, many things on today's show. Among them, the French Open, Champions League final, hockey, college baseball, super regionals.
Softball. Come on, college women's softball. It's got to be like the second or third best tournament in college women's softball.
There's been so much sports news lately. I mean, you have to make some cuts. There's just been so much going on. Am I crazy? I just feel like every now and then there's just like a week or two where there's just, I mean, scandals alone in the last week or two. It's been exhausting.
We're not going to talk about FIFA? We're going to find a way to talk about FIFA. But Josh is teasing us because...
Yeah. Yeah, our bonus segment, we are, in fact, going to cram everything in. We're not going to leave anything out.
No.
We're going to talk about every sporting event that happened this weekend because we want our listeners to be satisfied, our Slate Plus members. We'll talk about all these things and how to handle a weekend with an overwhelming volume of sporty goodness. To hear the bonus segment this week and others like it on Hang Up and Listen and various other Slate shows, sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/hangupplus. You can get a free 2-week trial if you want, and you get that at that same URL, slate.com/hangupplus. This past summer, when LeBron James decided to leave Miami, go back to Cleveland, and the Cavaliers acquired all-star Kevin Love in a trade, the Cavs became everyone's favorite to make it to the NBA Finals. That's exactly where Cleveland ended up, but in Sunday night's Game 2, none of the four players who started alongside LeBron in the season opener played for a single minute. Love, Kyrie Irving, and Anderson Varejao all out with season-ending injuries. Dion Waiters shipped out of town in a cardboard box many, many months ago. The eight players who took the floor against the Golden State Warriors included three Knicks castoffs, Timofey Mozgov, J.R. Smith, and Iman Shumpert, who were acquired in midseason trades. Two guys, James Jones and Mike Miller, who came with LeBron from Miami, are a combined 69 years old and averaged combined 6.5 points per game this year.
More impressive if they were each 69 years old.
They might very well be. I think Mike Miller has been lying about his age for years. Another guy, Matthew Dellavedova, who's an undrafted second-year backup point guard. And finally, Tristan Thompson, who is a very good player, a key to Cleveland's success, but has scored a total of 4 points in the finals thus far.
Backup second-year point guard from Australia. You left out the salient fact of Matthew Dellavedova's life.
Delhi. And yet the Cavs leave California with a series tied 1-1. Took both games to overtime, thanks mostly to great defense and LeBron James's 83 points, albeit on a wildly inefficient 29-for-73 shooting. The Warriors, meanwhile, suffered through a 5-for-23 shooting performance from MVP Stephen Curry on Sunday, but remained the favorites to win the series, given the Golden State was one of the best regular season teams in history, and Cleveland is running out of people who can play basketball. Mary, what did you see in those first two games?
You know, what I'm fascinated by is watching LeBron. And actually, I know we said we weren't going to talk about the French Open, but I am, because I think that there is an analogous thing with watching Serena Williams play. When you have an athlete who's so dominant, I can't decide whether it's boring because you're just totally sucked into watching them, or if it's fascinating because it's like watching, you know, a master of the craft. So watching him play with this team, even though I think the Warriors, in terms of depth of their bench, have a more skilled team in a lot of ways, I can't decide whether I like watching LeBron and the Cavs or not, because it's just such a bizarre situation, especially at this level in the season, right? I mean,
Right, and it's more fascinating than watching LeBron with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, because it's watching LeBron with four guys that he picked up at the Cleveland equivalent of 4th Street in Greenwich Village at the courts. It's bizarre. I mean, you know exactly what's going to happen, right? I mean, occasionally there'll be a kick out or a pass to a wide open J.R. Smith on the wing who will throw one up from 25, but you know that he is going to take the shot. You know there's going to be a clear out at some point on almost every possession, and he must have handled the ball on what, 70 or 80% of Cleveland's offensive possessions. Men, when I say handle the ball, I mean handle them on 100% of the possessions, but handle the ball with an opportunity to shoot. I mean, and I think the numbers back us up there. He took 40% of the Cavaliers' shots last night.
Yeah, and it is fascinating to watch, and he has scored a lot of points, but let's not lose sight of the fact that the Cleveland offense has been very bad. It's not like he is, you know, Serena, like, hitting aces on every point. The way that Cleveland has stayed in these games is because their defense has been fantastic. And this for a team that didn't really play great defense all year. And Dellavedova, in particular, on Stephen Curry in game two. I don't think I saw the stats after the game. I don't think Curry hit a shot when he was being guarded by Dellavedova. And the Warriors are a team with a great offense and a great defense, but known more and loved more by fans for just their crisp play, their passing, Klay Thompson and Stephen Curry's shooting. And defense is a little bit less fun to watch because it's frustrating the beautiful artistry of, you know, the guys that we want to see. And it's led to an ugly series. It's led to kind of frustrating play at times. But I think that's where you have to focus, Mary, if you want to talk about what Cleveland is doing right in this series.
Well, and I was wondering about the Irving injury specifically, like how costly that's going to be, right? Because he's kind of the other ball handler. And so I think the next game that'll be really telling. I mean, it's almost like it's not comical because we're talking about human beings being injured, but it's really insane what's happening on that roster right now at this point. And especially when you're so used to seeing LeBron play at this level with, you know, the Heat squad, like it just seems like it's hard to believe it's still the NBA Finals. Like it just seems like the play is so, so different.
And with Irving's injury, Stefan, we've talked about this so many times over the years. Is there an analogy to be made to, for example, Robert Griffin III playing in games in the playoffs for the Washington football team with a compromised knee, seeming like he's not really the same after re-injuring it? If I were to embody the role of Hang Up and Listen panelist Mike Pesca, I would say that this is the NBA Finals, and if you asked Irving at the end of his career, you know, do you regret making the decision to play in this game with having ankle injuries, having knee injuries, then he would probably say no. But what are your thoughts on Cleveland's decision, Irving's decision to play, and then what the outcome was?
These games are always governed by more than reality, by more than facts, by more than medical facts. And we know that. We see this in every sport. And we're more attuned to it now because particularly of what's happened in football and trying to make more sort of calm assessments about current state of health of an athlete and future state of health of an athlete. And look, we're not the Cleveland medical staff. Cleveland Clinic, very good hospital. Very good doctors there. I'm sure Kyrie Irving got some good advice. Good treatment. But yeah, it's hard to know whether the adrenaline rush of wanting to compete in a series where you know as an athlete that your team really does need you, where you are very, very shorthanded and playing, as you said, Josh, one of the best teams possibly in the history of the NBA. So that pressure on you, on Kyrie Irving, must have been enormous. And I'm sure he felt that pressure from his teammates. I'm sure LeBron wasn't sidling up to him saying, hey, Kyrie, man, you know, I'm thinking about 2017 and how important it is that you're healthy and that you get to that second max contract.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that point about this coming up in every sport is a really good one. And I mean, my impression has always been usually people play. I mean, usually it's the adrenaline of these athletes. And also, these are like multi-million dollar enterprises. I mean, whether he plays or not has all these other ripple effects, and he has like a whole team. So the human in me thinks it's like insane, but the person who watches this unfold every time is never surprised. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And the injury certainly made for a sad scene on the court and a very bad overtime in game one. But what these games have lacked in execution at times, they've made up for it in drama. And
intensity.
Those are really the
two categories.
You know, these are why we watch sports. Number one is to watch players like Steph Curry and LeBron James make plays that make our mouths go agape. And the other reason is that we can't anticipate what's going to happen and that something bizarre or crazy just might. And that's something that sports can provide that other forms of human entertainment cannot. And there were just so many plays. Zach Lowe wrote about this in his Grantland recap of game two. Two dozen little plays that were an inch away from turning out differently. The LeBron shots at the end of regulation in game one and game two. And so something that I just kept focusing on is the perception that calls were bad, often the I think correct belief that calls by the referees were bad, but just how impossible these games are to officiate. So I don't necessarily come down on blaming the referees.
Except for the Iguodala hack on LeBron's arm. I mean, that was pretty
bad. I think the ref was screened out. I mean,
might have been.
It's really easy to see that was a foul, but is it easy for that person in that moment?
I feel like it wouldn't be the NBA Finals if we weren't arguing about officiating at some point, right? I mean, this just always comes up.
Yeah.
And I think what also makes this great is that there is a real sort of subtext to what's going on the court. You know, whether it's the apparent head injuries, not apparent, the head injuries to Steph Curry and Klay Thompson in previous games, or to what the hell LeBron James must be thinking. Like, I'm playing with four guys from the gym. What the hell do I have to do in order to carry this team to a championship?
Well, he was playing against J.R. Smith at certain points in that game.
Yeah.
Smith was working at counter purposes.
Yes, he was. I mean, I think the Twitters were excellent last night. I've got a shout out to our friend Bruce Arthur, the Canadian, who wrote that the only difference between LeBron James and Michael Jordan is that Jordan would have murdered J.R. Smith on the court.
Also, the Curry frown face meme, I was totally behind. You know what I'm talking about, right? The shot of him just the sad. I feel so bad for athletes on live television because, like, think about it. If somebody was like recording us at the gym, I mean, nobody looks like you're so I don't know. And yet these things live on the internet now in this really unique way.
Thank God no one ever recorded me playing basketball at the gym, which I did a lot.
So the series is going back to Cleveland now for game three. It is in the 2-2, 1-1, 1 format. So it will be going back to Golden State. As I said in my intro, I think the Warriors are pretty clearly the favorite still. I think that we're in for a great Steph Curry performance coming up in one of these games. And the Warriors just have so many different players and so many different ways to execute offensively that it just doesn't seem like the Cavs can maintain this. And yet, this is why we watch. And if it is like you were saying, with maybe it's like Serena Williams winning in the French Open while vomiting into a towel. Mm-hmm. I mean, because right, LeBron right. is just at once the
J.R. Smith is the vomit in that analogy.
He is at once the ultimate overdog, you know, in terms of physical, mental, like just outshines everyone in basketball, and yet is just like wearing J.R. Smith sized weights around his ankles. It's just hard to think of a comparison of, you know, an athlete who's so great and so burdened at once. And that's really the joy of watching this series.
Yeah, it should be a piece of cake for him too. All the Golden State has to do is continue to put up the worst performances of the year for Cleveland to take things to overtime and have a chance.
I think that's right. All right, Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Here's a word from one of our sister podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jason Lincolns, host of So That Happened, a HuffPost podcast about the things that have happened in politics this week. This time out, we're talking about the Patriot Act and NSA reform. Who's hemming and hawing? Who's yelling? Who's taking credit? And what does it all mean for you? You can listen to our show each week at itunes.com/panoply or by searching So That Happened on iTunes or Stitcher.
On Saturday evening in New York's Belmont Park, the horse American Pharoah tried to become the 12th equine athlete to win the sports Triple Crown and the first to win the Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont since Affirmed did it in 1978. Here is track announcer Larry Colmis on the call.
And they're into the stretch, and American Pharoah makes his run for glory as they come into the final furlong. Frosted is second with 1/8 of a mile to go. American Pharoah's got a two-length lead. Frosted is all out at the 16th pole. And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
Writing about the race in Sports Illustrated, Tim Layden said, for so long, horse racing had been stuck on the same yellowed page. So many times the Triple Crown had seemed at hand, and so many times cruel reality dropped a hammer on old Belmont Park, and so many times a generation and more was left without a legend of its own to pass along, left instead to live with musty recollections growing more distant by the year. It was a bay colt named American Pharoah who finally set everybody free. Tim's piece was so good that it pulled off something even more unlikely than a horse winning the Triple Crown. It was widely praised by internet commenters. I am happy now to welcome in Tim Layden of Sports Illustrated. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks. I think I could have used another period in that sentence somewhere now that I'm hearing it read out loud.
Well, the commenters didn't point it out, so I'm sure it was perfect. Yeah. In the piece, one of the things that you kept coming back to was the word chingon, and Bob Baffert, the trainer, was telling you that throughout the lead up to the Belmont. Can you explain to folks what that word means, what the significance is?
Yeah, obviously, you know, I'm not bilingual. I'm barely monolingual. You know, I had a chance to... Bob was great. I've known him for a better part of a decade, or more than that, like 14 years. And he gave me pretty good access when he was under a lot of duress to give a lot of people access. And he let me hang out with him a few times. And Chingon came up when I was with him right in the middle between the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes, and we were watching a workout together from the box seats at Churchill Downs on an empty track. And it's a word that Martin Garcia, the exercise rider, was also a jockey, said into his walkie-talkie. He wears a walkie-talkie on his chest, and Baffert holds it in his hand. And when American Pharoah came onto the track to work out that day, he said, "Super Chingon." And Baffert started laughing, and I asked him what the word meant. And he tried to explain it to me, and he just said it means awesome, cool, tough, strong. It's like, and I wound up asking other people who are bilingual or who have a knowledge of sort of Espanol slang, and it's basically the most powerful thing you can say about somebody, especially an athlete or a cultural figure. And came sort of a touchstone that Baffert and I went back to a few times. And you know, as you guys know, as journalists, it became something that was only mine, and And I reminded Baffert about three times, you know, you're a chatty guy. Do not get up and say chingon. That's between you and me, and I'll make good on it eventually.
Baffert says in your piece, Tim, we've had a lot of good horses. I've never had one that moves like this. Never. You called it powerful yet effortless. What does that mean? What do horse people appreciate in American Pharoah that we non-horse people can't really see?
You know, it's and again, I'm not a horse trainer or a horse breeder, so this is I'm learning. You know, I covered the sport on and off. It's not a full-time gig for me or anybody that's trying to pay bills. It's hard to know, but I mean, basically, the act of a horse running over the ground is a violent act. You know, animals weigh more than 1,000 pounds landing on limbs that are no bigger than your legs and smaller in most cases. And so it's a sort of stunning act, and American Pharoah completed that act in a way where he's able to reduce the stress that he puts on his body and on the ground, and he has a great angle in his shoulder and the front of his body, which allows him to reach out particularly far with his front legs, and also the ability to get his rear legs underneath him a long distance, push off very hard, and throw himself forward. And to do all this in a way that's not disruptive. He runs smoothly and powerfully at the same time. The additional factor in all that is that he doesn't tire himself out doing it. He's efficient is the best way I can put it. I mean, it's like, you know, you watch a great Ethiopian distance runner, and it just doesn't look like he's moving, and he's running faster than most of us can sprint. That's the way it is with American Pharoah. He's just, and all great horses. Secretariat wasn't necessarily that way. He was just powerful. Whereas American Pharoah was more efficient, I guess. It's really the best word that kept coming up.
I have a non-horse question. You know, horse racing as a sport is in such a strange place. It's just been plagued by, you know, scandal and controversy. Do you think that this win will give the sport itself some, you know, an injection of goodwill or arouse interest from non-horse people or expand it, or is this kind of a flash in the pan?
Yeah, I don't. That comes up so often that, you know, Mary, the way it was, like, for so many years, people would say, you know, as you're going through the Triple Crown, you'd hear journalists or people in the business say, oh, man, you know, horse racing needs a Triple Crown winner. And my response to that, and I really like covering the sport, and I wanted to see a Triple Crown. You know, I missed the last one. You know, I mean, I was drinking beers with a bunch of buddies on Cape Cod when the last one happened. I certainly wasn't filing a story afterward. So, I mean, my view is, I want to see one. I think it'll be a really cool thing if it happens, and it really was a cool thing. You know, top five sporting events I've ever been around. But yet I don't see how that's going to put people in the stands at Finger Lakes on Thursday. You know, I just don't, you know, I was talking with Bill Roden from the Times very late Saturday night leaving, and I said, you know, a great column to do for people that want to make that point is to come back out here Thursday to Belmont Park and take the pulse of the place then when it's, you know, 65, 70, 75-year-old guys from Queens and the Bronx watching simulcasting on TVs and shuffling around and maybe going out to watch a horse race. I don't want to take the totally cynical attitude about that, because I do think there is a lot of short-term excitement about seeing the athletic achievement, and if you were there, feeling the roar of the crowd and the emotion. I think all that was great. It was a great day. But I think it's a mistake to try and project too much onto that. You know, I mean, my recommendation is to embrace the day, the achievement, but horse racing has much more complex issues to resolve if it wants to survive as an enterprise. But otherwise, I think it's a niche sport, like pretty much everything in America is, except the NFL and maybe college football. You know.
So the Triple Crown is just a very difficult thing to achieve, as we've seen over the last 37 years. And there was some talk before this year of maybe changing the rules, and is this something that's too hard? Steve Coburn, the owner of California Chrome, which failed in its attempt last year, was, in my perception, kind of whining about it, saying, oh, these other horses didn't have to run the Derby and the Preakness, and they just got a free run at my guy and got to play spoiler. Is this, you know, the fact that a horse was able to achieve this, is this vindication in some way for how difficult it was that it took a horse this special to do it? Or is the Triple Crown still just an odd thing, and the fact that the Belmont is longer than any race that any of these horses ever run, and it's 3 races in 5 weeks for horses that aren't built for it, is it still something that doesn't particularly make sense?
I don't know about whether it makes sense. I mean, everything you said is right. I mean, it could be 37 more years. It is very hard to do, but people in the game that weren't whiny and that weren't revisionists have been saying for a long time, eventually the right horse will come along. And even when the right horse comes along, there are mitigating circumstances that are just, it's just partly luck. I mean, the horse stayed healthy, and that's like, you know, the Golden State Warriors have generally stayed healthy. That's like sort of this X factor in all sports that's very hard to predict. But that horse stayed healthy. And when the Belmont came up, he got a pace scenario. He was the fastest horse in the race, which allowed him to get to the lead and control the pace. And from a purely athletic standpoint, he was able to run at the slowest possible speed that he could maintain and still keep the lead for almost the entire race, really up to the last quarter mile, and then really start running fast. And if there had been a fast horse that would not be able to finish the race well, he might have been able to pressure American Pharoah more and tire him out earlier in the race. So the race set up very well for him. There were a lot of circumstances that fell in line to make this Triple Crown achievable. As far as changing it, the Triple Crown isn't a unified body. It's just a name given to these three races by a sports writer a long time ago. It's three big races run by three separate racing commissions with three separate layers of political influence and intrigue, and the likelihood of those three bodies getting together and agreeing to change the dates of their biggest races of the year, I think we're stuck with it as it is. And, you know, my best hope is that from a writing standpoint, you know, thank heavens that I or anybody else that continues to write about this sport either all the time or once in a while doesn't have to juggle that storyline anymore.
It's also, these things are supposed to be hard. I mean, I think we often forget, or it's often overlooked, that there was no Triple Crown winner between Citation in 1948 and Secretariat in 1973, 25 years. That was a long time, too. And that predates the era of really genetically working and breeding these horses to make them something that maybe Mother Nature didn't intend, to make them more fragile and make them less susceptible to being able to pull off this kind of an achievement.
One of the things that people forget when they get hung up on a horse winning the first two legs and getting to the Belmont and the Test of the Champion and the mile and a half is the Kentucky Derby is the hardest of the three races to win. It's earlier in the year. The horses have been through a grueling bunch of prep races. It's hard to get into that race under the current point system. And there's 20 horses in the field. I mean, there have been some great horses that won the Preakness and the Belmont but didn't have the Derby. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of ways in which the series is difficult, but that's the one that gets overlooked. Bob Baffert had a horse named Point Given 13 years ago that won the Preakness and the Belmont easily and was probably every bit as good as American Pharoah or better, but, you know, he got caught up in some traffic in the Derby and didn't win that one. So it's an overlooked hurdle, and it might be the biggest one of the bunch.
So we were talking a little bit about the ownership of the horse and the decision to keep the horse racing. You know, you were talking about kind of the storyline of the sport now that we have a Triple Crown champion changing so much. But there's also this new one that's so interesting, right? I mean, because that's pretty unusual. And what do you think about that decision and also kind of how the owner has come across in the media in the last few days?
Yeah, he's a complicated guy. I mean, he's Ahmed Zayat is a guy who... you know, he's had a lot of financial entanglements while also making a lot of money, and he's done a good job of keeping his personal wealth separate from his horse wealth. That's also caused him to not always pay people on time, including Bob Baffert. But at the same time, he pumps tens of millions of dollars into the industry buying horses. So it's kind of an attrition issue that you really need wealthy people to give you horses. For a guy like that to stay in the business when you have a horse like American Pharoah, but many other fast horses on a lower scale, once that horse proves that he has value, then you want to get him to a breeding farm or at least make a deal with a breeding farm so that you can then breed that horse for $15,000 or $25,000 or $45,000 or $55,000 for every, getting a little too literal here, but every mating with a mare, and then you get that money or you get a share of it, and that's how you keep your business operating, really. So here Zayat is sitting on a horse that's won the Triple Crown for the first time in 37 years. He already has a stud deal which is valued, I've heard, anywhere from $6 to $8 million to $15 or $20 million. And if the horse were to run in a month and break his leg, that money, he's got insurance, but a huge source of revenue for him is gone. That's a difficult decision, which people will criticize him for if he doesn't run the horse frequently. But you know, that horse will never be more valuable than he is today.
Ultimately, Tim, you know, the Triple Crown is such a big event, and this is such a historic achievement. But underlying a lot of this are these problems in horse racing. Your former Sports Illustrated colleague Jeff McGregor tweeted after the race, "Good, now that we've had a Triple Crown winner, let's go ahead and ban horse racing." And he linked to a list of the 43 equine deaths in New York so far this year, including one on Saturday at Belmont in a race earlier in the day. And this is an industry plagued with issues involving drugs and treatment of horses and the way they're bred and trained. Is there a balance to be achieved going forward, do you think?
Well, I'll say two things. You know, the first thing is, if you are inclined to be repulsed by a sport in which people get on the back of beautiful animals and urge them to run fast around a track and hit them with a whip, and they're kept in a stall for 23 and a half hours a day, if you are inclined to dislike that or be repulsed by it, I don't know what is going to change your mind. And I can certainly see and defend that position, or I can understand how that position is defensible. If you are more in the vast middle ground, then what you hope is that we reach a point where there's at least minimal drug use. And I think the sport has moved somewhat in that direction. If we get rid of that entirely, we're a long way from that. A lot of trainers, including Bob Baffert, thinks you can't run an active stable without Lasix. You can't keep horses healthy. It's a huge industry that requires a lot of races at a lot of tracks on a lot of days, and most of them aren't as well-bred, splendid animals as American Pharoah, and they need a lot of help to keep racing. And if you want to say those horses shouldn't be racing at all, then I just don't know how you run the industry. It's a problem, without a doubt, and I don't have the answer.
I want to get one final thought from you. And, you know, like Mary was saying before, I don't even know what the mechanism would be for this event to save horse racing if that were to happen. Like, how would that work? But, you know, this thing happened on Saturday. As you said, it was in the top five sporting events that you've witnessed, and you've seen a lot in your career at Sports Illustrated. Just, you know, describe to us a few, like, scenes or details of, you know, what the crowd response was and what it felt like to be there.
I watched the race from a catwalk right in front of Bob Baffert's box. There was a loud roar when they went into the gate, which is not uncommon. And then as American Pharoah led the race and went around the track, the roar got louder and louder and louder. It sounded more like a college football stadium on a Saturday night or you know, Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke or something, one of these players, the old Chicago Stadium, where it's really started making your ears hurt a little bit. I've never heard that kind of sound. The uniqueness of it was everybody in the building or everybody in the facility was rooting for the same thing. And then for me, from an intellectual and emotional standpoint, having seen so many of these and having been disappointed at not getting to write that story and then eventually fatigued at having to write the same story over and over again, to look straight down at the track maybe five strides from the finish line and seeing American Pharoah go by, and I didn't feel an emotional response at that point. I felt an intellectual response, which was, he's actually going to win this thing. And I couldn't even process the thought. And I mean, I realize that's a personal response rather than an environmental one. I mean, the noise was still in my ears, and I was kind of overwhelmed by that. And then there was Bedlam, and there was, you know, people was trying to follow Baffert and Zayat down to the winner's circle, and the high-fiving and people crying, and it was just an overwhelming emotional circumstance. And for anybody who's spent a day at a sporting event writing it and then leaving, you're kind of wasted anyway. But when the result has been disappointing or unsatisfying, you're doubly wasted. And this time I just walked through there and I thought about Smarty Jones and I thought about Real Quiet and Silver Charm and Big Brown, and it just felt this sense of closure which you don't usually get. And it made the walk to my car a little shorter, I guess.
That's great. And this piece that you wrote was great. And maybe the last thought you had was, maybe someone will want to have me on a podcast.
Well, I didn't think that, but I'm thrilled that it happened.
All right, Tim. Well, we'd love to have you back. And thanks for doing it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Tim Layden is a writer for Sports Illustrated. Okay, last topic. The Women's World Cup started in Canada this weekend, bringing the promise of happier news for FIFA, the international soccer organization, which is, you might say, embattled. You could also say that it's a fucking catastrophe. I wouldn't argue with you. But the Women's World Cup, rare beacon of inspiration in the international soccer world. There is the matter of games being played on artificial turf rather than natural grass, a fact that led to a lawsuit that was ultimately unsuccessful. And yes, maybe there will be more blowouts this time around with 24 teams this year, up from 16 in 2011. But Germany's 10-0 win over Ivory Coast on Sunday, that wasn't that much more dominating than Germany's 7-1 thrashing of Brazil in the Men's World Cup last year. Then there are the American women, role models to young girls and the rest of us, who will make their World Cup debut against Australia on Monday night. Among their number, goalkeeper Hope Solo, who, according to reporting from ESPN's Mark Fanaru-Wada, appears to have concocted a phony self-serving story about her role in an alleged incident of domestic violence in which, according to which person you believe, she either beat up her nephew or was beaten up by the same Stephen.
I think we all agree that there was a domestic violence there. That wasn't alleged.
But I think that what was fascinating to me about that story and the reaction to it is this now kind of new common trope in sports journalism. And it seems to happen a lot with domestic violence. Ray Rice comes to mind, where you have the redemption story. And I know this sounds insane, but when I read the original ESPNW story about Hope Solo and she's, you know, on, you know, I think she was even wearing white. Like everything about it seemed to be focused on creating this image of cleansing. It reminded me of Joseph Campbell. And I was like, agents and PR people know this plays to people and that it really resonates. But the aftermath of it and the fact that it's way more complicated is often what we as journalists see that's so much more messy. But
yeah, I mean, the Hope Solo thing has been nuts. Like how many different time she's transgressed and been redeemed and, you know, that she's just misunderstood. And the interesting thing about it, and Richard Deitch, who we had on this podcast a few weeks ago, had a good column on this, is that it was really a good test case for Fox, which is broadcasting the Women's World Cup, any World Cup for the first time, how they would handle this outbreak of news during a sporting event. And, Stefan, they didn't do a very good job.
No. Most of Deitch wrote, most of the panel came off as auxiliary PR for Hope Solo and U.S. soccer. And I watched the games on Saturday and took notes about the Fox panel, and I was impressed. They had a 5-woman panel. They were all smart and they really focused on the games. And I've been sort of energized by the fact that a lot of the coverage in the media has been about the athletes and the teams and their prospects and really treat it as a serious sporting event. And I think that's even in contrast to 4 years ago in the Women's World Cup, which was in Germany. But Deitch nailed it. I mean, he quoted directly from the panelists that Fox had in their booth. And it was they were almost to a person dismissive of the reporting, pretty much ignoring it, not really raising what the substantive facts of Mark Fanaru-Wada's reporting were. Old news said Leslie Osborne, who played on the U.S. national team with Solo a few years ago, you know, right now we're focusing on the tournament. Why are we focusing on Hope Solo? Angela Huklis, another former U.S. national team player, said, guess what? Australia and the U.S. play tomorrow. And then Eric Winalda was in the booth on Sunday. Not a woman, by the way. Just want to clarify that. This stuff is starting to get annoying to me, he said. Save it for Judge Judy. I mean, oh my God. I mean, Winalda, let's stipulate, always comes off as a condescending know-it-all. But talk about not understanding anything about the intersection of sports and life or about what news is or the way domestic violence has dominated the sports conversation for the past year plus. And more important to me, as Josh alluded to in his opening to this segment, the greater role that the U.S. women's national team plays in terms of the age of its fan base and their responsibility as, air quotes, role models. That, to me, is the issue. The NFL at this point seems to have more common sense about how violent, misbehaving athletes should be treated than U.S. soccer does. In his piece for ESPN...
That's uncalled for. That's a yellow card.
That's a yellow card. I'm going. That was a hot take.
Yeah.
I'm going hot.
The
I'm going
soccer.
Hot. Let me finish here, Mary. I'm not
okay,
done
okay,
hot
sorry,
taking.
Sorry.
And I think one of the most important points that Fanaru-Wada makes in his piece is that U.S. soccer didn't really even appear to investigate at all what happened that night between Hope Solo and her half-sister and her nephew.
They claim they did.
Right, but that's a phone call, and the Hope redemption story should have been made. I mean, how did U.S. soccer get a total free pass on how they handled this situation? And I get the argument that, you know, it's a bummer to be on the U.S. team now and not be Hope Solo and just trying to focus and have all this, you know, media static. But at the same time, it's the Women's World Cup. It's a massive sporting event, and you can't have that much attention on a sport at the highest level, whether it's men or women playing, and not have news happening and not have this kind of scrutiny. And so the fact that the governing body was MIA and nobody really questioned that until after, I was really surprised by.
Wait, and that's not to say, Josh, that there isn't room to just talk about this for a while. Just talk about it legitimately. Have a short conversation if that's all you really want to have, but have a legitimate conversation. And then, fine, let's talk about Germany's 10 goals against Cote d'Ivoire.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't think that U.S. soccer necessarily should have, like, conducted their own investigation. I have problems with how the NFL has done that. But if you say that you did, then you should have done it. You can't claim to have done something and not done it. That's when you lose respect of fans. That's when you need to be called out by media members. And that is what didn't happen in this Fox telecast. And there are questions about the bidding process for the, I mean, it almost seems like so insignificant compared to all the other horrible stuff that FIFA has done. But there are questions about the bidding process that led Fox to get World Cups that it wasn't bid out. And just as viewers, you want to think, and ESPN, for all that we criticize them, has done really a solid job on soccer, has just proven themselves repeatedly with their coverage of the FIFA scandal, you know, in the last couple weeks, and also with their coverage of the last few World Cups. And I think it was disappointing to a lot of soccer fans, myself included, that they didn't get the World Cup. And this performance by Fox on the opening weekend just makes it seem like I was right, or we were right.
Should we get past the Judge Judy now? Let's talk a little bit about the tournament. Is that
yeah?
Okay?
How are the games on Saturday, Seven?
The games on Saturday were fascinating. I think the Canada only beating China by 1-0 was, you know, it was China was terrific, and this was a team that used to be a women's soccer power that has really fallen off.
99 World Cup final, the famous one. They went to penalty kicks against the U.S.
Right, and Canada had needed a penalty kick late in that game to prevail. And Canada is a team that is projected with the United States and France and Germany and maybe Brazil as being the likely contenders to reach the final.
538 has them at 7th going in, just in case anybody's wondering.
And to talk about legitimizing a sport, the fact that 538 sort of has done a matrix of projection indices for the Women's World Cup, I think, is another great indication that the sport is being taken seriously and the progress that's been made. On the turf issue, Josh, Fox reported during the Germany-Ivory Coast match that it was 73 degrees in the air and 110 degrees on the field. In the Norway-Thailand match, temperatures reportedly were up to 130 degrees on the turf.
It's insanity. I mean, and just think, what if the Women's World Cup was held in Qatar on artificial turf? Like, geez, Louise, like, we're putting people in, like, microwaves. Like, it's insane.
So, Mary, what are your thoughts on the appeal of this event to an American audience? You can just talk about your appeal to yourself, or you can project onto everyone else who lives in this fair country. I'm fascinated by how the U.S. team is going to do. I want them to win. I root for them. I find their games quite enjoyable. But this is a large event in which the United States only plays a few times. Are you going to be tuning in to see Germany and Norway and the other teams? And if the U.S. goes out early, which I think is a possibility, what do you think that's going to mean for the event?
Oh, what a great question. You know, it's interesting because the world, I think soccer in general, the men's and the women's game, is in such a weird place in the U.S. right now, because now you actually do have people, and the World Cup showed this, here watching. Like, we have soccer fans in a way, and I've always been blown away by this because so many kids, me included, play soccer. We know the sport, but then at the pro level, it drops off. It's been this constant thing, blah, blah, blah. So I do think there's going to be more interest than ever before. And something else that's happened organically that I think helps a lot is the depth of the women's game has improved so dramatically. The question is, how much are people going to be following these storylines? Because unlike Europe, you know, this isn't something that is paid attention to in the U.S. And I was at the London Olympics for the U.S.-Japan final, which, by the way, Sepp Blatter was booed at, and that was in 2012, in case anybody, if we want to have a Sepp Blatter boo count. And so I think there are these really compelling storylines. It's just a matter of how interested people are in them when it doesn't involve the U.S. The U.S. team is really, I think, amazing to watch. And I actually think that sometimes the earlier sides of any tournament, including soccer, are more interesting to watch. I feel this way about March Madness because there are some upsets. There are some surprises. There is some drama. So I don't know. I think it's better than it's ever been, but I still think women's soccer in the U.S. has quite a ways to go in terms of really feeling out its, you know, whole potential for women. And I think the turf for fans, and I think that the turf thing is insane. and I hope that you know, changes soon.
Well, the New York Times Magazine had a piece on Sunday titled "Why Is U.S. Women's Soccer Still Fighting to Exist?" And yeah, I think we've talked about the reasons for a lot of that, and it has to do with sponsorship and marketing and attendance on a week-to-week basis as opposed to a quadrennial event that has been proven to attract audiences when the United States does well. I mean, there's got to be some anxiety among people at Fox and elsewhere that the United States won't make it as far as they have in the past. While this tournament's been expanded to 24 teams, and there's going to be a lot more, there are a lot more weak teams in this event, as we saw with Ivory Coast, and you'll see with Thailand and some other countries that are playing in the World Cup for the first time. Really, at the top, it has improved enormously. And part of the reason it's improved enormously is because there's a professional league in the United States that's been sustainable. It hasn't been killing anybody, but it's been sustainable. And there are professional leagues in Europe that are sustainable, where a lot of the American women have chosen to play rather than play in the United States. So, again, I've always been of the mind that this is a 30 to 40 to 50-year project, both for men and women. I mean, the U.S. men beat the Netherlands over the weekend 4-3 in one of the great soccer games that a United States national team has ever played. So on the women's side, the fact that we have all of this year, we have all 52 games airing on television, and we have the sort of really noticeable change in how the media is covering the event. These are all incredibly positive things that are cumulative.
But it seems to me that, like, this is paralleling the conversation we had about the Cricket World Cup and how there's an argument within that sport about, do you want to add teams that aren't as good and grow the game, quote unquote, at, you know, the expense of having these blowouts? And also, you know, the conversation we had about the year in the Cricket World Cup when India went out early in the tournament and then nobody watched the rest of the tournament. I feel like you guys are not willing to say that you will be tuning out in droves if and when the U.S. goes out early. I certainly will not have the same interest, and I'm not apologetic about it.
I will have no choice because I have tickets to the quarterfinal, semifinal, and final game. So I'll be there no matter what.
Well, and I think the U.S. team, I mean, to be honest, I think you're right. But I think that what's also been so effective, you know, to Stefan's point, is that they have characters on that team now. And there are Abby fans and, you know, and there are people who care about Hope Solo, which is why that news story is getting so much attention. Like, there are these, it's a really mature team in that they aren't new faces. And so when they leave, you know, I don't know the lineup for Germany or Japan as well. And I don't think I'm unique in that regard.
Sawa.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it doesn't mean they're not tremendous athletes with fascinating stories, but they're just not written about in the U.S. as much. So I do think that you lose this cast of characters that American fans are starting to get to know.
Right. The opponents at this point are, you know, they play the role of foil, and you don't want to see foil versus foil in the final. All right. Let's move on to our afterballs. And I was looking at a list of nicknames for women's national teams, and there are some good ones. According to Wikipedia, the Colombian women are Las Chicas Super Poderosas, the Powerpuff Girls.
That's amazing.
The Nigerian women are the Super Falcons, in contrast to the men who are the Super Eagles. But my favorite is the New Zealand women, who are known as the Football Ferns.
I knew that.
When I look at the New Zealand national team, I think they look like nothing more than vascular plants that reproduce via spores.
Go Ferns. Everything involving New Zealand is bizarre and awesome at the same time.
Do you have a football fern for us, Mary?
So I kind of I've been thinking a lot, and I know, you know, FIFA, everybody's sick of it, but I've been thinking a lot about this idea of sports fans as voters. So in the last couple of weeks alone, there have been scandals in FIFA endurance running. We haven't talked about Alberto Salazar, but ProPublica had a report that strongly implicated him as a coach in, you know, doping accusations in a sport that has been no stranger to that, of course. Horse racing, earlier we talked about American Pharoah's controversial owner. And then, of course, you have Sepp Blatter, the longtime Cruella de Vil of FIFA. And I think that often, you know, the reaction to these stories is the same among fans. There's this sense of anger and outrage and a feeling of, you know, how could this have happened? And there's also a sense of hopelessness. But I think it's insane that fans are actually sometimes the most empowered people in the whole scenario, but they don't really act that way, or they don't necessarily connect the dots. So, for example, if you look at FIFA, a lot of the money involved in these bribery allegations, according to the Justice Department, has come from these huge lucrative broadcast contracts from Fox to Telemundo, as well as corporate sponsors from brands that we do know. And even if you're not a sports fan, I'd be baffled to know why you're listening to this podcast, but you would know, you know, McDonald's, Budweiser, Nike, Adidas, Visa, Coca-Cola. And John Oliver, in this really great skit for Last Week Tonight, he, you know, he was making this bargain to FIFA sponsors that he would wear, you know, these Adidas shoes that he felt were really hideous. He would eat McDonald's dollar menu and drink a bottle of Bud Light Lime, which I unfortunately have tasted. It's pretty not, it's not my drink of choice. If they would get rid of Blatter, which ultimately ended up happening. And even though we don't all have John Oliver-like exposure, he does make a point that we can move with our dollars, and we don't take advantage of that enough. And, you know, if you look at what happened with the NFL and domestic violence, what I would argue really changed in that conversation was there were female football fans, and they did put pressure on the league and its sponsors in how it handled those cases. There is potential that sponsors could act more decisively going ahead, whether it's an individual or not. But so far, the public statements and all these scandals that I've, you know, outlined have been basically finger wagging. Nobody's actually said they're going to yank their checkbook. And it's an indirect connection, right? So with Lance Armstrong and Nike, you could argue that those brands were really closely linked. With FIFA, I don't know who goes and buys a pair of Nikes and thinks, oh, this organization is involved with this massive, you know, DOJ complaint, and that implies that the, you know, organization has been involved with bribery. And I think that there is a distinction between sponsoring an individual, an athlete, and an entire organization when a league usually has a monopoly on a global sport. So historically, companies haven't hesitated to end those relationships with a professional athlete. But with leagues, it's a lot more complicated. With the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, sponsors were blasted in the press on social media, but some of them, such as Coca-Cola, actually defended these partnerships. So I guess my call is to sports fans that if they don't like something, that's totally fair enough. But if people want to see things change in sports, whether it's on field or off with governance, it's time to start seeing your checkbook as your ballot box.
A refreshing lack of cynicism from Mary Pilon.
By the way, John Oliver did actually follow up on his pledge and chugged some Bud Light Lime on his program on Sunday. He described the taste as the Jolly Green Giants ejaculate. We said it tasted like.
Stefan, what is your Jolly Green Giant? Excuse me, what is your football fern?
I'm sticking with the FIFA. Sticking with the FIFA. Big weekend in soccer, everybody. United Passions, Josh referenced at the top of the show, $607. At 10 theaters in the United States. That is an impressive,
has there been, I don't want to interrupt your afterball mojo,
sure,
but has anyone reported on why that movie got released
in the United States? No.
Seemed like a bad idea that this isn't Monday morning goalkeeping. Like, you could have known in advance that that movie was not going to do well, but continue.
All right. A South African newspaper reported that Morocco actually won the vote to host the 2010 World Cup, but FIFA manipulated the results to award the tournament to South Africa. Our corrupt Trinidadian sportocrat Jack Warner reportedly accepted $1 million to vote for Morocco before taking another $10 million to vote for South Africa. He kept the million, though. A FIFA official said that Russia and Qatar could be stripped of the 2018 and 2022 tournaments if they are found to have been involved in bribery. Haven't they already been found to have been involved in bribery? And we also had Thailand's women's football team make its World Cup debut. Josh, you did not mention that the Thai women's football team is nicknamed the War Elephants. This afterball could have been perfectly synchronous with the afterball name that Josh came up with without my my suggestions.
Letting you get some of your own lines.
All right, fine. The War Elephants lost 4-0 to Norway. Should have been a lot worse. They did hit a crossbar, save a penalty. The Thai women are here at the World Cup because they beat Vietnam to win one of 5 Asian slots in the expanded tournament, after which the Royal Thai Football Federation announced plans for a golden generation of women's footballers. So good on Thailand, right? Who's leading that charge in Thailand? His name is Warawi Makudi. He's the head of the Thai Football Association, longtime member of FIFA's executive committee. He was the chairman of FIFA's Women's Football Committee and of the 2011 Women's World Cup in Germany. After the Thai women qualified for Canada, he announced bonuses of 15 million baht, or more than $400,000 for the team. And after they lost by only 5-0 to South Korea last fall, he rewarded them with 200,000 baht, $6,200. Great guy, right? Actually, total FIFA scumbag. Alleged, of course. Alleged total FIFA scumbag. Let's round up some of the choice allegations against the 63-year-old Thai sportocrat. In 2011, Lord Treisman, the former head of England's Football Association, accused Warawi in Parliament of offering to vote for England for the 2018 World Cup in exchange for the TV rights for himself, personally, to a Thailand-England friendly that would commemorate the anniversary of the King of Thailand's accession to the throne. I don't know how a Thai sportocrat sounds, but Warawi said that the accusations are not true and groundless, and my reputation, I'm going to go into my European sportocrat voice, has been tarnished, and it defames my family. FIFA said it investigated, and shockingly, it cleared him. A Bangkok Sports Daily reported in 2011 that Warawi had resold FIFA tickets to the 2010 World Cup for personal profit. He sued the paper. What are you going to do? You got to sue the paper. A source told Australian journalist Jesse Fink in 2011 that when our Thai sportocrat was about to lose re-election as the head of the Thai Football Association, he canceled the election on the day it was scheduled to occur, cut electricity to the building where the election was to be held, and left the country. Where did he go, Josh? Journalist Andrew Jennings, who's reporting, if you go back and read it, is a blueprint for the Justice Department and FBI investigation. He said that Warawi flew on Qatari FIFA member Mohammed bin Hammam's private jet to Trinidad, hello Jack Warner, carrying $1 million or so in cash to be used to bribe CONCACAF members to vote for bin Hammam against Sepp Blatter for FIFA president. Warawi said he didn't see any of the money. Also in 2011, he was accused of using FIFA development grants to build soccer facilities on land that he owned. He denied that too. To back him up, he produced a letter from the disgraced FIFA General Secretary Jerome Valka. London newspapers reported last year that Warawi or Thai soccer officials cut a range of deals with Russia and Qatar prior to the World Cup votes. Warawi and his reps apparently traveled to Russia right before the voting. He reportedly was directly involved in a deal signed in 2012 for Qatar to deliver 2 tons of liquefied natural gas via a Thai energy company that also happens to be a sponsor of the Thai Football Association. Finally, he's reported among the 10 FIFA executives being investigated by Swiss authorities in connection with the Russia and Qatar votes. He threatened to sue anyone who said he was involved in corruption. Warawi's time as a soccer fat cat may be up. In 2013, he lost a bid to head the Asian Confederation. And last week, amid the news of the Swiss probe and the U.S. probe, he failed to win re-election to the FIFA Executive Committee seat that he had held for 17 years. The Asian Confederation instead elected 3 new delegates, a Kuwaiti sheikh, a Malaysian prince, and remarkably, a former Japanese soccer player, just a soccer player. That's it. One real soccer player.
I love the election. What did he do? He canceled the election, cut off
cut the electricity to the building,
and
that's
left
an amazing
the country.
Move.
And left the country.
I would even, if I think if I was in a rage, I wouldn't even think like, and I'm cutting the electricity. Like,
but that should be a business school case study. Like, there's some great redundancy there. There's no way that he's going to lose that election.
Exactly.
He will not charge your smartphones.
Yeah. You could cancel the election, but you still might lose. I'm going to cut the electricity.
Let's not forget, though, go War Elephants.
Go War Elephants.
Go War Elephants.
All right, Josh, what's your football fern?
So I was looking at a list of horses that have failed to win the Triple Crown after winning the first two legs, and it's a longer list than the one of animals that succeeded. In just the last few years, there's California Chrome, Big Brown, Smarty Jones, I'll Have Another didn't start in the Belmont due to tendinitis. At the very beginning of the list, is a horse named Burgoo King, which won the Derby and Preakness in 1932. In a list of equine failure on SB Nation, Burgoo King's performance in the Belmont is listed as did not start unknown reason. Burgoo, in case you're wondering, before we get too deep in this afterball, it's a spicy stew. It's often served in Kentucky and made of whatever meat you find lying around. Options include possum and raccoon.
Please don't say horse.
Not horse. I mean, whatever meat you find lying around in Kentucky seems like would probably include horse, but I'm just going to go with possum and raccoon. Burgoo King, the horse, though, won the Kentucky Derby by 3 lengths, beat a horse named Tick On by a head in the Preakness. So why didn't Burgoo King run in the Belmont? Some people say it's because the horse's owners did not file the proper paperwork, which would be a very dumb reason if true. More likely, it seems to me, is that the horse was injured. The Triple Crown apparently wasn't as big a deal back then because Burgoo King actually raced between the Preakness and the Belmont on something called the Withers Stakes. not a good name, not a good omen. The horse might have gotten injured in that event. Whatever happened, Burgoo King did not race at the Belmont, didn't race again until he was 5 years old. But the bigger mystery involves the horse's jockey, a teenager named Eugene James. James started riding in 1930 as a teenager, age 16 or 17, won the Kentucky Derby on Burgoo King as a 19-year-old, 1932. According to a story in the Thoroughbred Times, James was from Louisville, learned to be a jockey by riding his uncle's mule. James got to ride Burgoo King in the Derby because another jockey named Laverne Fator, who had his pick of mounts, decided to ride a horse named Brother Joe instead. Burgoo King won. Brother Joe finished 19th. Eugene James looked to be at the start of a brilliant career. But according to that Thoroughbred Times story, James was bulimic, which is an unfortunately common affliction for jockeys back then and today. His bulimia reportedly led to a serious stomach disorder, which led him to stop riding. In 1933, at age 20, James drowned while swimming in a Chicago lake with an ex-boxer named Society Kid Hogan.
Oh, that's a good nickname. They don't make nicknames like that anymore. Society Kid.
Keep in mind that somebody just drowned, like in that exact sentence. According to the Chicago Tribune,
60 years ago,
James, 80 years ago,
sorry.
James suggested the swim, but did not, this is a quote, did not heed Hogan's warning that the water was too cold for such an effort. A few years ago, a Louisville news station published a story in which James's relatives alleged that he had been murdered by mobsters. He was probably asked to throw a race, said his second cousin, and he was so young he didn't know not to tangle with the mob, and he wouldn't do what he was asked. There's no explanation given for why they think he was murdered by mobsters, so I'm not really able to assess the truth value of that statement. But here is the crazy thing. The jockey who decided not to ride Burgoo King, the one who finished 19th, in the Derby, Laverne Fator. 3 years after James's death, he reportedly committed suicide by flinging himself out the window of a hospital room. There are questions about that death, too, with some people believing that he was suffering from a fever due to appendicitis and fell out of the window in a delirious state. So the lesson here, do not research long-ago jockeys if you do not want to be overwhelmed by weird and disturbing deaths.
Was Burger King named after Burgoo King?
Did you see the thing about the Burger King King, like Bob Baffert getting money?
$150,000 to have a Burger King stand in his box.
A Burger King mascot.
The Preakness.
It all comes full circle.
Totally.
We all knew that's how that story was going to end.
We'll write an existential play involving all of these characters. The real horse, Sepp Blatter will show up.
The real O. Henry ending was that Burgoo King would have been turned into Burgoo. But maybe in the play, in Mary Poulon's one-act play.
We'll get FIFA to underwrite it. They'll finance it. It'll be great. Yeah.
It'll be a box
Tim
office
Roth
smash.
Will be
sponsored by Bud Light Lime.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe to Hang Up and Listen in iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our producer this week is Alexis Diao. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Andy Bowers. Thanks to Mary Poulon for being with us this week. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our intern, also Emma Zahner, remembers Alma Beatty, and thanks for listening.